In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we hear from Professor Eric Larson, author of A Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit, and also the book The Skull of Yorick, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Grave Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one. USDA admits exterminating birds, crops, and bees. The USDA has been under fire recently for its admitted assault against nature, after multiple investigations have uncovered its deliberate tampering with both plants and animals alike. One such investigation has put an end to the mystery surrounding the death of millions of birds, with USDA documents revealing the organization's role in the massive slaughter. In addition to the mass bird killings, it turns out the USDA was fully aware that a highly popular herbicide chemical was a known bee killer, which may have aided the bee decline. The USDA has also threatened the genetic integrity of the nation's crops. Information has surfaced regarding the USDA's illegal approval of Monsanto's biotech crop sugar beets. These crimes are simply an excerpt from the long list of USDA crimes that are continually being exposed. In December of 2010, mystery struck the world, as many listeners may recall. Reports of mass fish and bird die-offs were coming in from Texas to Sweden. The first occurrence in the series of strange events started in Arkansas, where 3,000 birds fell from the sky. In the following days and weeks, similar incidents were reported with no solid explanations. The reason has now been found, thanks to documents found on the USDA's website. Claiming to be protecting farmers from predators, the birds were victims of a little-known government program. Like millions of other animals, since the Bye Bye Blackbird program was created in the 1960s, the birds were poisoned and killed for being considered a nuisance to farmers. It's important to take note that many of these animals do not pose any immediate threat to farmers. In the 1960s, the USDA established a program referred to as the Bye Bye Blackbird program. This program is solely responsible for the mass killing of what could ultimately be millions of birds across the nation. In 2009 alone, the USDA poisoned and killed more than 4 million birds. You can find extremely large numbers, such as 22,276 blackbirds, marked as intentionally euthanized. Here are some data from the USDA itself. Brown-headed cowbirds, 1,046,109 dead. European starlings, 1,259,714 dead. Red-winged blackbirds, 965,889 dead. Canadian geese, 24,519 dead. Pigeons, 96,297 dead. Grackles, 93,210 dead. These numbers are simply the top for 2009. The article continues. What's important to know is the connections between Monsanto and the USDA and the FDA. Last September, John Rappaport put out an article titled Meet Monsanto's Number One Lobbyist, Barack Obama. It reads, during his 2008 campaign for president, Barack Obama transmitted signals that he understood the GMO issue. Several key anti-GMO activists were impressed. They thought Obama, once in the White House, would listen to their concerns and act on them. On the campaign trail, Obama said, quote, let folks know when their food is genetically modified, because Americans have a right to know what they're buying. Making the distinction between GMO and non-GMO was certainly an indication that Obama, unlike the FDA and the USDA, saw there was an important line to draw in the sand. Beyond that, Obama was promising a new era of transparency in government. He was adamant in promising that if elected, his administration wouldn't do business, quote, the old way, and he would be responsive to people's needs. Well, then came the reality. After the election, as many listeners know, and during Obama's term as president, people who had been working to label GMO food and warn the public of its huge dangers were shocked to the core they saw Obama had been pulling a bait and switch. The new president filled key posts with Monsanto people in federal agencies that wield tremendous force in food issues, the USDA and the FDA. This article continues, and it lists the people who were appointed in specific positions to regulate food in this country with Monsanto connections. Here they are. At the USDA, as the director of the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, Roger Beachy, former director of Monsanto Danforth Center. As deputy commissioner of the FDA, the new food safety issues czar, the infamous Michael Taylor, former vice president for public policy for Monsanto. Taylor had been instrumental in getting approval for Monsanto's genetically engineered bovine growth hormone. As commissioner of the USDA, Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack. Vilsack had set up a national group, the Governor's Biotechnology Partnership, and had been given a Governor of the Year award by the Biotechnology Industry Organization, whose members include Monsanto, as the new agriculture trade representative who would push GMOs for export, Islam Siddiqui, a former Monsanto lobbyist, as the new counsel for the USDA, Ramona Romero, who had been corporate counsel for another biotech giant, DuPont, as the new head of the USAID, Ravi Shah, who had preciously worked in key positions for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, a major funder of GMO agriculture research. Obama also nominated Elena Kagan to the U.S. Supreme Court. Kagan, as Federal Solicitor General, had previously argued for Monsanto in the Monsanto-Gertzen seed case before the Supreme Court. The deck was stacked. Obama hadn't just failed to exercise proper oversight in selecting appointees. He wasn't just experiencing a failure of short-term memory. He was staking out territory on behalf of Monsanto and other GMO corporate giants. The article continues. It reads, "Let's see what GMO crops have walked through the open door of the Obama presidency. Monsanto GMO alfalfa, Monsanto GMO sugar beets, Monsanto GMO soybean. Coming soon, Monsanto's GMO sweet corn, Syngenta GMO corn for ethanol, Syngenta GMO stacked corn, Pioneer GMO corn, Syngenta GMO BT cotton, Bayer GMO cotton, Atrin, an anti-clogging agent from the milk of transgenic goats, a GMO papaya strain, and perhaps soon, genetically engineered salmon and apples." We continue the discussion with Professor Eric Larson, editor and publisher of the Oliver Arts and Open Press, a novelist and writer. He is the author of the book Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit, and The Skull of Yorick, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Grave Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. Professor Larson published 5 essays at intrepidreport.com, extensions almost of his recent 2 books, and the essays are an important book for understanding what did and what did not happen on 9/11, and he's referencing Dr. Judy Wood's book. Another essay, Serpent Songs in America, another one, Delusional America and 9/11, and Dr. Judy Wood in the Future of the Earth. Once again, Professor Larson takes on the writers in the mainstream progressive media and exposes the subtle lies and turns of phrase used by the writers to lead the reader down a path of lies regarding the content of Dr. Judy Wood's book, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. Professor Larson has edited Where Did the Towers Go? He wrote the foreword to it. He reviewed it. He also wrote an op-ed piece about the American scientific establishment's inability to support it because of the risk of professional threats against its members if they were to speak out in its favor. Professor Larson, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here, although not necessarily a pleasure to be discussing what we're going to be discussing.
It's not easy to discuss this material, but you had written 5 more essays in addition to your 2 books, in essence an extension in terms of the content of The Skull of Yorick and A Nation Gone Blind. Why did you continue writing these essays?
The 5 current ones are kind of illogical. In fact, they are illogical outgrowth from the book review I wrote of Dr. Wood's book when it first appeared, or very shortly after, and a couple of other essays that I wrote then, not as part of a series, but simply because the issue was still sitting there and people were still distorting it, ignoring it, suppressing it. So I wrote one very critical of Paul Craig Roberts called Serpent Songs in America, and that didn't cause anything to happen, so I came upon a piece by Roger Cohen in the Times sentimentalizing and romanticizing 9/11 as a piece of literary lore equivalent to that, say, of E.B. White. And I called that Delusional America and 9/11. And then I sat on my haunches for a while and watched and read and began to perceive that there was, in the case of Dr. Wood's book, a particular specific new suppression of it. And the suppression was becoming more and more laughable, more and more ludicrous, more and more hysteric, really. And it had to do with the subject that is the key subject in her book, and that is the subject of free energy. I set out to write about this denial, if you will, in the press and in journalism. It came out to be 5 pieces long. And I don't think the job is done, but at least a good solid step has been done.
Serpent Songs in America, that essay about Paul Craig Roberts, I don't mean to simplify it, but can you tell listeners what you meant by Serpent Songs?
Oh, absolutely. Roberts has been for some time now an advocate and backer of Richard Gage and his Engineers and Architects for 9/11 Truth, and says that they've proven that the buildings were brought down, that they didn't come down, they disappeared, but that they were brought down by controlled demolition and discovery of the particles of nanothermite in the remains proves that nanothermite or thermite of some kind or a thermate reaction of some kind was used to destroy the buildings. Well, now, he says that's proven. He goes on at various points and says things like, you know, if an architect says that there was stress enough to bring down the building, you can bet your life that it's true. I can't remember which of his very many, many, many essays he says that, but it's just astonishing, the rabidness with which he adheres to this position. But he will not look at a shred of evidence from Dr. Wood's book. And so it seems to me that that's hypocritical, and that's a serpentine kind of thing. That is a serpent song approach. He flatters the reader into a understanding along with him of the controlled demolition concept, but then he betrays the reader by denying that there's other evidence that is even more compelling that shows molecular disassociation of the materials of the buildings. To me, that's very, very enormous. It's a huge matter.
I understand the serpent part of it, the serpent in the Garden of Eden,
yeah,
with Eve. The serpent flattered Eve.
That's right.
Gained her confidence in
that's
a way.
Right.
And that's essentially what's going on here, is the writer gains the reader's confidence and then delivers a subtle but lethal...
That's right, yeah. It's curious about some people like Roberts. He never, if you look back through the essays, and there are hundreds of them, he complains with a grand, acerbic, usually accurate manner and sense of outrage, but he never, ever, ever advocates a plan or suggests a way of repair. He just simply assaults the situation as it is, and it certainly deserves that. But why does he refuse to look at, for example, something that is really can open a doorway to a method, a means by which to oppose the tyranny that's brought about these horrors? But he won't. He will not do it.
And he allows the illusion that these architects and engineers are going to fix things?
Yes, very much, and it is such an illusion. They're a shabby, wrong, deceitful, hypocritical bunch, as they go at least under the aegis of Richard Gage. I have evidence of that in my piece, the fifth piece, and Andrew Johnson has more than plentiful evidence of it in his book, 9/11 Finding the Truth.
Let's talk about that evidence that you wrote about in Dr. Judy Wood and the Future of the Earth. I think it's part five.
Yeah, the most recent is,
the most.
And the last. As written up by Andrew Johnson, the story goes the following. A medical student in the Middle West named Abraham Rodriguez was a backer, as I was even, of the Architects and Engineers group. Certainly, we all knew that it was not airplanes that had brought down the towers. The number of people you see referring to that being the case still is just shocking to me. But nevertheless, Rodriguez came upon the work of Judy Wood. This is well before Where Did the Towers Go had been published. It was before 2010. And he went to a meeting of a presentation by Richard Gage and approached him with a curious question, and it was this. Rodriguez had, in fact, even donated money to the group, and he had signed the petition that the group then had. And then he wrote Gage and asked, whoa, this is really interesting new evidence. I wonder if you're aware of it and whether you're going to investigate it. And what he found out was, having asked that question, got him dropped from the petition. They unsigned him. And he was shocked by this, so he went again to a presentation and approached Gage. Well, the upshot is that Gage was proved himself to be a wily backpedaler, wouldn't meet Rodriguez squarely or fairly. Finally, they offered Rodriguez a refund, as if that would help, but not a reinstatement of his signature, not that he would care to have a signature on the petition any longer. But in any case, Rodriguez received an email explaining their position regarding Judy Wood, and the email said, well, we know about her work already, which I wonder, but it's not within the scope of our mission. So in other words, it contains evidence that is not compatible with their thesis, therefore they ignore it. In part five, I point out that that would be one of the quickest ways to get a one-way ticket out of grad school that I can remember. If you have a thesis and you ignore evidence that supports or distorts or disproves it, you're going home. That's not what you do in scholarship. So there's very simple evidence. Robert Gage Group, 9/11 Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, is a fraud. It's an outright, without question, hands-down fraud. This is the same. I had occasion to come upon the American lawyers. I don't know if they call themselves lawyers or attorneys, but it's a parallel group, American lawyers for 9/11 Truth, and they appeared exactly parallel to the Gage Group. So there's no help there.
The architects and engineers for 9/11 went ahead and said, yeah, we're excluding her information. We're not going to collect all the evidence. We're going to come up with our own theory that fits the evidence.
Absolutely. I did no work. I just read the emails and followed some videos and such things as that. In part five, I have a page that just simply lists some of the evidence contained in Where Did the Towers Go that the Gage Group ignores. I have in part five of my Dr. Judy Wood and the Future of the Earth piece a list of 14-point list of evidence that's ignored by the Gage Group in order to bolster their own position. It's not a complete list, but it has, for example, the fact of the absence of seismic evidence of two 500,000-ton buildings. There's not sufficient seismic evidence of that amount of mass having hit the Earth. Mm-hmm. And in the case of building number 7, there's no seismic evidence suggesting that none of it hit the Earth. So in any case, they ignore that. They ignore the toasted cars. They ignore the fact that there were flames that had no heat or an insufficient heat to sear a leaf or burn a piece of office paper. Those are just some examples. It goes on and on and on.
Well, we'll hear more from that list a little
okay.
bit later.
Sure, good.
A listener asks, both sides of this argument feed the energy of lower vibrations. All parties involved are fighting over who has the greater intellectual understanding of the system that enslaves them. He says there can be no winner here. That is the trap of continuously circling through the lower vibration. Well, the energy issue aside, the spiritual part of that aside, what do you say to a comment like that?
Oh, I say that it's not correct at all. It's understandable, and it's exactly what the cover-uppers want. The cover-up is based essentially on muddling up. I think in part five, the most hilarious parts have to do with Dr. Jim Fetzer in Madison, Wisconsin. And he's a major kingpin in the 9/11 truth movement, which in his case very clearly is the 9/11 let's suppress Judy Wood movement, though he claims virulently that he's a backer. But it's just, if you read that section, it's just hilarious. He's making just completely nonsensical objections. For example, Judy Wood says, listen to the evidence and it'll lead you to the truth.
I read that. I couldn't believe it. That was really amazing. Can you describe what's going on there?
Yeah, Fetzer says, oh, that's not correct. She's wrong because some of the evidence that she cites is visual, or some of it is seismic, and or some of it is in form of testimonies. No, I like that. That would work. But what he's saying is that every piece of evidence has got to be auditory, or else it won't it can't be included, since she says, listen to the evidence.
You can't use figurative language?
Can't use figurative language. Even when the user and the listener both are fully aware that it is figurative. I point out that if you adhere to his absurdity there, we are all forbidden and prohibited from ever saying, from Herrick, Robert Herrick, gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Gather ye rosebuds. Herrick was not writing about somebody running around a field picking flowers. He was talking about people growing old faster than they would ever believe. So obviously Fetzer is himself fraudulent and a clown. But the intensity, the activity, the movement, he's like the Energizer Bunny, I believe I actually said. He just keeps on going and churning out this nonsense. And, of course, anybody who says of themselves, oh, I'm not really a scientist, so I can't understand something like that, he's just feeding their position. He's telling them, oh, she's not a real scientist, so you don't have to worry about understanding her. And so he's creating confidence among people who are already not confident. And it's just so destructive.
This connects to what you wrote in the last essay. You asked about whose fault is it? And you say, I think the fault lies with you, me, with us. It lies with us thanks to our impotent thinking and our impotent writing, where sounding good passes itself off as doing good. The fault lies with us thanks to our intellectual laziness and to our obscenely bad educations. It lies with us because Cyril was right. We are so logic challenged that we behave like children and think we're wizards. And this continues. But you point out that Fetzer was gaining confidence of the reader who were not confident.
That's right.
And we're in this area here.
That's right. He fills with confidence the lack of confidence in people. The listener who mentioned that there can be no winners is wrong. But that has to do with Americans' ignorance in science. And, of course, that word ignorance, when I was teaching for all those decades, I used the word freely, but I always assured my students that if I called them ignorant, it was only with the best of intention and with the biggest of heart. Because it was to say of them something that was easily curable, completely and easily curable. And the patient wishes to be cured from ignorance, it can be done. So I urged them to join me in that quest.
So it's important to untangle all of this around us, that are broadcasting lies and deception regarding Dr. Wood's book, what happened on September 11th, and free energy.
A good number of people who do this are not evil-minded cover-ups people. Many of them are functioning really out of their own lack of confidence, but it's a lack of understanding of what science is. Dr. Judy Wood does not have a theory. The Gage group said, we know all about her theories already. Well, they don't. If they're using that word, they don't know about her. Because what her book amounts to, what it offers and what it is a proof, not a theory, but it's a proof that the towers were destroyed by some form of directed energy weaponry, free energy weaponry. And because she can't identify the make, model, and serial number and the location of the presumed origin or source of the weapon, those at least like Fetzer, say, well, it can't be. That's supposition and that's theory. But on the other hand, it is not. And if somebody is shot with a .30-06 caliber bullet and they're dead, And if the police don't know where the killer is, where the weapon is, or what color stock the weapon had on it, or what make of cartridge the weapon fired, that makes no difference. The person is still dead of a .30-06 gunshot wound. And similarly with the towers. What got them was molecular dissociation brought about by the field effects in directed free energy technology. And the book is a book that proves that. Jerry Mazza has written on liberal and progressive causes for the Intrepid Report for a long, long, long time, even when it was still called Online Journal. But he won't admit it. He won't admit that science is not different from argument or debate. Science, as I say in Part 5, progresses not by argument, but by proof. And those, many, who, for whatever their reasons may be, wish to muddle up or obfuscate or suppress or distort Dr. Wood's book and conclusion, are using that as a method, thinking of science as something that is a matter of argument. It's not. It's a matter of proof. Even in the great things that we call still the theory of, you know, the gravitational theory, the theory of evolution, the relativity theory, science uses the word theory in the sense, a very extraordinarily important sense, that literally, philosophically, if you will, the theory of relativity hasn't been proven, but of course it is proven. That is to say, the example of a light switch. If you come into a dark room, turn on the light, and the lights come on. Turn the switch, and the lights come on. And you leave and turn the light switch off, and the light goes off. And you do this for 100 days in a row. You're going to conclude the light's going to come on when you switch the switch.
By what
but
method?
This is by inductive reasoning. If you say to someone, that's then a theory, that the light's going to come on. Well, indeed, it is a theory, because maybe the light won't come on. But scientifically, it's valid because in lieu of anything else happening, like the circuit wearing out, a wire getting frayed, or the bulb burning out, it will indeed come on. People are taking this up as a means by which to attack large proofs of a scientific nature. And they're still doing it, of course, with Darwin. I mean, they're still trying. But, you know, how do the creationists attack Darwin? They do it by ignoring the evidence every time, again and again. They'll say, hey, we believe in God, and God must have created, you know, animals and their various forms. Darwin showed that, well, maybe God did create him once. I don't know. But he certainly didn't control every single aspect. Or even if he did, there is evolutionary change in observable form that has been for millennia. So the ignoring of evidence is the key means by which to distort or ignore this proof. But the book is a proof. Free energy exists. And this is why, too, I've called these essays Dr. Judy Wood and the Future of the Earth. Our very future, our survival, depends on whether we can harness free energy and thus escape the murder of the Earth that we're so far embarked on at this point. And as long as she's, for whatever the reasons people may have, they're multiple, I'm sure, but suppressing Dr. Wood's work is to suppress the most important thing that we've come scientifically to see or know since Copernicus and Galileo. There is a strong statement, but it's a true one.
You wrote in one of your essays, consider the sheer effort that Dr. Wood has made, the years and years and years of observation and study and research, not to mention the additional effort and time given to the actual writing of the monumental Where Did the Towers Go? Would anyone lack a sense of sympathy for the human dimension of the present political moment to go to so immense an effort to bring hope and a concrete step toward relief and security to millions of people who are now in harm's way? You paraphrased some of that already, but I thought it was very extremely well put here.
Dr. Wood is a very big-hearted, she's an enormously huge-hearted humanitarian, as well as an extraordinarily adept scientist. Her memory is enormous and acute. Her powers of observation are just stunning. Again and again, readers of her book who are paying attention will see, looking at any one piece of evidence, whether it's statistical or whether it's photographic or whether it's transcriptual, she will say something like, well, notice the in the one upper left-hand corner. Or notice the choice of word that the person used there, and you'll realize that these are crucially important in listening to the evidence accurately and fully.
In your last essay, Professor Larson, titled Dr. Judy Wood and the Future of the Earth, Part 5. In this title, The Future of the Earth, well, I do understand what you mean by that. And this technology is in the wrong hands. It's not being used for free energy. It's actually being used as a weapon. And we've seen signs of this. And I suspect, as do many other people, this directed energy weaponry could be used under the cover of conventional weaponry or during natural disasters, and many more examples. Do you know of other examples?
Yes. Well, I know of them. Yes. I would refer here to Andrew Johnson, the wonderfully committed and dedicated observer and thinker and collector of evidence. He lives in England. Has a website that is of extreme interest. It's called checktheevidence.com. Recently, Andrew put a piece up. I believe it was a paper that he delivered at the same energy conference in Belgium that Dr. Judy Wood attended within the last 2 weeks. And his piece talks simply about the suppression of knowledge of free energy, the enormity of the significance of this. As Dr. Wood herself says in the book, we have a choice. We can save the Earth and the inhabitants of it, or we can see them all destroyed. The choice is ours. Of course, we can see the Earth destroyed by a couple of different ways. One is by weaponry itself, and the other is simply by continuing with the fossil fuel society that we have. Global warming is true. The destructiveness of the resource wars is obvious. The depletion of those kinds of resources, also obvious. Now, I was interested the other day seeing a piece by Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed. He's the brilliant fellow, also living in England. Is English also. Wrote two books. What was the first one? I can't remember. It was so much better the second time around. The War on Truth. And it was one of the greatest of the great books, giving the history of 9/11 from the time of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan through the collapse of the Soviet Union and then to the event of 9/11. All of that being a very tidy, clearly self-contained piece of history. So Nafiz wrote this extraordinary book, and recently I wrote a piece of his called, now I can't quote the exact wording, but it says, what are we going to do in the after in the post-petroleum age. And his position simply is that the world will die if we don't change from a capitalist, consumerist, rapacious, depleting society. The world will die. It can, though, be saved by a change in attitude and change in social structures that serve to maintain rather than to use up resources. But it's interesting that he doesn't mention free energy. And so it seems to me that there's a huge, huge element in his thinking that's not there. That's what Andrew Johnson is talking about as well, and Dr. Judy Wood. However, she doesn't go beyond the fact of her proof. Her proof is that the 9/11 made use of directed free energy technology. And she asks, are we going to use it or are we going to be destroyed? So the significance is enormous. It's a moment of a change, of not just historical change, but of Earth change. It's one of the moments when the human race has a possible chance, has a real chance of saving itself from itself, and it also has the opportunity not to do so. The suppression of the free energy truth or proof, it seems, I don't understand how it could be other than that it must be being engineered from the highest sources that are intent upon maintaining the hegemony of the petroleum industries worldwide. Unless that can be changed, the future, the prospect is rather dire, but the proof is there. It's our energy. Apparently, J.P. Morgan said to Nikola Tesla, when he was hearing from Tesla about the existence of free energy. I guess it's an old story. Everybody knows it. But Morgan is supposed to have said, free energy? Where do you put the meter? And, of course, Tesla died before being able to demonstrate what he was hoping to demonstrate, the transmission of free energy around the world. But that his death came before that, before he was able to do so. But he was able to do so. He was ready to do so. He was going to do so.
And the FBI raided his laboratory and his hotel room. And that, I guess, leads back to the technology in the wrong hands right now. And we see evidence of that. And you mentioned about Andrew Johnson saying weaponized free energy has been used a number of times. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, well, his position is that it's, and he's a real hawk for observing and following, that there are at least 100 examples, though he does not itemize them, whereby it's been used and can be known to have been used.
And I suspect that the free energy weaponry is used under the cover of conventional weapon, the cover of natural disaster, and things like that. And only an observant person such as Judy Wood and people who are learning from her will be able to see the signature of a directed energy weapon being used. And it reminds me of that story from New Zealand, Christchurch, New Zealand, of an engineer in court testifying some details about the destruction of a particular building, and he went into describing evidence similar to Dr. Judy Wood's evidence in her book. It takes a lot of investigative work to follow through on something like that, but you're hearing bits and pieces.
You need to read the book. The book helps you with the understanding of the premise very, very, very much. She's a very clear, lucid writer, and she has the reader in mind every minute of the way. But you know something on this line I should mention is that I think this is only me. I've never heard anyone else say something of the sort, but to me, one of the most shocking things during the late Bush administration was Cheney, his eagerness to destroy Iran's nuclear research. And it was absolutely shocking to hear heads of state speaking so loosely of that extent of destruction, the supposition being, at least in my mind, that the means would be by nuclear energy, by nuclear weapons. And for anybody of the stature of Cheney, Bush, other, you know, Condoleezza Rice, to even suggest that idea is absolutely hideously irresponsible. And that they were, of course, speaking from the one country that ever has used nuclear weapons as a nuclear energy as a weapon. It was particularly shocking. I think, though, that what they're really going to do if they do something like that, they're going to use directed energy weaponry. That will have, for them, the great advantage of doing immense destruction without radiation. This puts a very, very dire light on the whole situation. The weapon is a perfect weapon.
There is fallout with disintegration.
Oh, yes, the disintegration. That is part of the destruction, of course, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because the process, as it was applied in the World Trade Center, is a non-self-quenching. That's the phrase that Dr. Judy Wood uses. It's a non-self-quenching process. It's not like a fire that's created by oxidization. Once the material that is being oxidized is depleted, the fire goes out. Or once the oxygen is depleted, the fire goes out. Once the temperature is reduced, the fire goes out. But Dr. Judy Wood has observed signs of ongoing process of molecular disassociation having gone on, continued for years at ground zero. One thing is very evident, and that's the rapid rusting of steel beams. Beams that rusted, they shouldn't have rusted almost at all, but they were rusting heavily within a couple, 3 years after 9/11.
Professor Eric Larson, you've written exhaustively about the concerns of the American public and how they're thinking. You call it infantilism. Can you just describe again what that is?
Yeah, I can try to, and I think I can. It's an unhappy subject. One way in which it works, and this is the less awful way, but one way is in the, as we were mentioning before, the placing of confidence in people in order to reinforce their lack of confidence. But in A Nation Gone Blind, the book I wrote in 2006, I call that dumb dumb rights. And it's very, it's not completely off the wall to say that Americans tend very much to value and cherish their dumb rights. And, okay, but we've talked about that already. And people are flattered for their dumbness, and that does not help anyone except the cover-up camp. And so that is a form of being and being infantilized and being maintained as an infantilized person. You know, sort of, boy, I'm good, I'm great, I'm dumb. You laugh at a dumb person sort of like you do at a little kid because they're innocent. But in this case, it's not a matter of innocence. But worse, is the same phenomenon, but on a scale far, far larger. It extends throughout all of the arts, throughout all of American literature, throughout all of American journalism. It's part of the whole dumbing down process and principle that we've been reading and talking about for the last 20 years. But it's creeping in, has crept into the most serious echelons and levels of the artistic cultural establishment. There cannot be a serious political book published in America today by any commercial publishing house. There can be published by little tiny presses, but not very many of those. I only know of one. That's mine.
Oliver Arts.
The Oliver Arts and Open Press, which will not judge any work on the grounds of its breaking of barriers in speaking on what may have been considered or are considered taboos. Well, let me put it this way. When Frank Rich, I think this was back in 07, reviewed a book by Dan DeLillo, and the book was called Falling Man. And the title of the book came from a character who was going around New York City and falling, deliberately falling, from places like train trestles and such, to be arrested by a bungee cord. And this was extremely shocking in the book to people who were observing him because it reminded them of the falling man or the falling people coming out of the World Trade Center on 9/11. Well, take it from me. The book is terrible. It's an awful book in many ways. If you're interested in the details, pick up The Skull of Yorick and read the last chapter. But Frank Rich took the book and he ran a front page review of it in the New York Review of Books with such high praise that it's just astonishing. And if you read his essay, you read remarks made by DeLillo, they're just being silly. They're being so... I make the parallel between their behavior and the behavior of little circus dogs in tutus dancing for the dog master. They're saying absurdities. They're singing praises of things that ought to be condemned by everyone, like the beauty of destruction, the upliftingness of catastrophe. You read that, and then read it in the context of someone who criticizes it. I think it's terrifying. And that's infantilism of an aggressive and a mean, a destructive kind. Then there's the infantilism of contentlessness, whereby a writer who Tom Engelhart particularly likes, named Rebecca Solnit, I find her a perfect example of the empty progressive writer. She's just empty. In part five, in what I call impotence writing, where the sound or the appearance of significance passes for significance, something like that. But it seems to me that that's the kind of writing that...
I think I have it here.
Yeah.
Because this is a really good paragraph. Here it is. It lies with us thanks to our impotence thinking and our impotence writing, where sounding good passes itself off as doing good.
Sounding good passes itself off as doing good. I remember a review that Dwight Garner ran in the Times. Now, I'm not going to be good at this name, the name of the book or of its author. It's sometime back, and the book didn't come up to the promise. It was, again, it was overlauded. But the glee and the silliness and the Hollywoodization of Garner's treatment of that book, because it was so-called a 9/11 book, were shocking, just shocking. And it's a little bit like the Roger Cohen sentimentalizing 9/11. in the times also. So these are aspects of people not just not thinking, but agreeing that they're not supposed to think, and therefore thinking stupidly within their not thinking parameters. It's a little bit like taking the vitamins out of a baby's food or formula, and I don't know what happens then. It's not good. But the baby doesn't die, but the baby doesn't talk as well, think as well. It doesn't ever become an adult. I think in the New York Times, Tom Friedman is another one, Dwight Garner, are in many, many a way infantilized writers. That's described in more fully in As the Skull of Yorick as well.
In that essay of infantilism, I think it's Delusional America, 9/11.
Yeah, yeah.
You write, living in an environment of deceit, fraud, and deception in lies has carried the American population to an even higher plateau of infection, debility, blindness, and handicap. In short, Americans have begun going insane. Well, is that in the defense of American people?
No, it's not. I think the insanity... Walk down the street. In fact, I was walking down the street just this afternoon and observing people, and I notice how comfortable they often are and how they are involved in their daily affairs. They're talking with their children and they're talking to one another. And there's nothing wrong with that. Heaven knows there's nothing wrong with that. But at the same time, the nation that they are citizens of is set upon destroying the earth. Or very nearly destroying the earth at this point, waging how many wars by count? Shall we begin to count the wars? Like Elizabeth Barrett said, let me count the ways. How much do I love thee? Let me count the ways. Well, we could count the wars, could we not? With the prospect of more to come. For what? Well, these are wars that are essentially they're territorial resource wars. They're wars against people and peoples. They're wars against nations. Our nation is now the worst on the earth. It's the most aggressive, the most destructive, the most intolerant, the most unfair. And we, as a people, technically, on paper, enjoy perhaps the fewest freedoms of anyone in the world. Certainly not protected by habeas corpus, not protected from the will of a president who may choose to arrest us and put us away forever without any evidence or any hearing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're spied on, we're threatened. Why? Well, how can it be that these things have happened to us and we're letting them happen if we're not insane? Isn't it insanity to go on living a regular life without taking heed of these immensities of destruction? To me, it's an emergency, to put it lightly.
It also reminds me of how are you going to take responsibility in your life for living in a country that's doing this?
It's interesting. That's where I get into impotence writing. The question about taking responsibility, the question of taking responsibility, is possibly the greatest question that's being ignored, maybe in the history, certainly in the history of the West. As a citizen, one has responsibilities. As a citizen, most Americans have only privileges. They don't think about responsibilities. And I think that that's a large element in what I call impotence writing and impotence thought. It seems almost to me as if it's gone so bad so far, and there's a certain form of madness that's been acculturated and taken for granted for so long, that even people who are the most in despair at what's going on seem unable to propose any kind of an action to counter the horror. A writer of that kind that comes to mind, of course, Paul Craig Roberts is one example that I've spoken of. Another is Chris Hedges. It's a very interesting fellow. I thought his first book was terrible. War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. I didn't like it at all. I objected to it on a very strong number of grounds and very powerfully. I didn't say anything. I didn't really know much about him at the time. Somebody said, read this book, or if you don't, you're just really losing out on one of the most important things of recent writing. Didn't agree. But now I find I've followed him now for several years after his departure from the Times, and he's like Paul Craig Roberts in that he can't or won't take responsibility. He says he's taking responsibility. He says everything he does from now on is going to be, he's going to put his foot down, he's going to go to rallies, he's going to sign petitions. But where's the program? There's no program. Where's Occupy Not Wall Street? They're gone. Why isn't there a program? How can someone like Chris Hedges, how can someone like Paul Craig Roberts, how can someone like, oh, Professor Jim Fetzer, Kevin Barrett of Madison, Wisconsin is another. I saw him a video snippet just yesterday. And he's still pushing for Richard Gage. He's still pushing for controlled demolition by a thermate or thermite. What's wrong? These people either are infantilized and can't think, they are prejudiced and therefore won't accept all of the evidence and look at the situation for what it actually is, or there's another motive, whatever it might be, for them to keep truth from being revealed. The truth, that truth being that Dr. Judy Wood has proven for us, the earlier proofs have been reproven, and proofs of Nikola Tesla, that free energy exists, free energy can be harnessed, free energy has been harnessed, free energy was harnessed as early as 1910, and it has been repressed and suppressed ever since. Now, the cost of that suppression seems to me higher than ever in history.
We don't have the opportunity to get these ideas out together as a progressive group. And I feel that you criticizing the progressive leaders and writers was important. And as you pointed out with the use of the word ignorant, you know, you're not doing this to be mean to people. You're bringing out some important observations where this could be why we're in the situation we're in, where we've put our trust into the progressive left to come forward with this investigative work and this information as the grown-ups in our society to say, you know what, we found out what's going on here. Here's what's going on. And I think it's important to have a critique of this. Otherwise, what are we doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, otherwise, what are we doing? The grown-ups is exactly the right idea. A person can think of a conservative as the kind of kid who wouldn't share toys. And a person, I always thought of progressives, liberals, leftists, as those who would step in and say, come on now, of course we're going to share. Everyone is going to share, and it's for the best of us all. But I studied in Madison, Wisconsin for a period. I was very fond of the city and of the state with its great tradition of the progressive ethos and the history of fighting Bob La Follette. He, in fact, the founder of the Progressive magazine. And anyway, so this is about 10, 15 years ago, and I, in a fit of ideal ambition, I subscribed to a number of different things, and one of them was a progressive magazine. I'd always wanted to subscribe to it, never had, and I dropped it after a year. It was not it's not a progressive magazine. It's not a politically alert. It's not a politically assertive. It's not a magazine to find answers. It's a magazine to find impotence writing from front to back, week after week after week. And in fact, it put itself out as a huge antagonist toward the 9/11 truth movement many, many years now ago, unnecessarily putting itself on the side of, oh no, it can't have been an inside job. 9/11 was done by box cutters and Arabs and airplanes. So they're in such a wilderness as a backwater that I find it shocking, despairing, frankly. I don't know where there is a progressive movement. I don't know where they are. I know where a lot of the names are, but I don't know where the movement is, and I don't know where the heart of it is. Nor do I think anyone else does. But we need it. We've got to have it. Got to find it.
I do think that Andrew Johnson is part of it.
Oh, absolutely.
And even I think John Hutchinson, people like Dr. Carmen Bolter, who have revealed the importance of matriarch societies.
Yes.
That,
yeah.
I don't think we'd be here with an integration of the patriarch and matriarch.
Yes.
And I think that is part of what's going on.
Never has there been such a rich, so many riches of thought as there are now. But I don't think that ever has that richness been less made use of. than now. If only the material's there, the minds are there, the fragmentation socially and politically is also there.
The access to the information.
Access to information is there, but the fragmentation, the power and the might of interests that exist in order to keep people's attention away from significance is the greatest force there is. I don't know. I know that I know I want people to work, study, listen, respond, try their best to see through the nonsense.
I have a feeling that you're kind of coming to an end with this type of writing in your life. And I feel that because you're going to do this and go back to literature, the following is going to probably increase the people who are going to start reading these essays. And
well, that would be wonderful if it happened. Yes, I'm going back to literature. I'm writing a series of books. One on Homer is being finished now, moving on to Greek tragedy, and from there on up to Virginia Woolf, as well as novels of my own.
Oh, that's great. It's really important because I had a revelation about some of the work that you're doing here, and I felt that you sacrificed yourself in putting this material out and the criticisms out and untangling the subtle lies and exposing these subtle turns of phrase that these writers are using for whatever reason to hide important truths that we all need to understand in order to evolve and can go to the next level. So you did all that work. You did all that work, I think, for other artists in the sense that our last interview was about how living in a media landscape saturated with lies is detrimental to any kind of artwork, especially writing.
Yes, it is. I have a series of essays that have not been republished. I did put on my website back in 06, 07. A series called The United States is No Longer a Serious Place. And that's exactly the idea. That even if it's not a political matter, our literature today is not looking, by and large, most of it fails to look seriously, even at the smallest elements of life. And without that, how can the biggest elements be looked at seriously? There's a big subject there, and it's a live one.
Professor Eric Larson, the editor and publisher of the Oliver Arts and Open Press, a novelist and writer, author of A Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit, and the book The Skull of York, one of my favorites, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Grave Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. Thank you so much for being a guest back on In Other News.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff. May we all have the best of luck.
I know. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.